Tonight our study is in the 13th chapter of Deuteronomy. And this is still Moses' speech to the people. And as we've mentioned before, they are located on the banks of the Jordan River in the plain of Moab, shortly before they're ready to make their crossing into the land of Canaan. And the most of the book of Deuteronomy is concerned with the few days before they get over into Canaan and make that crossing of the Jordan River. And in these few chapters that we're in now, Moses is explaining some of the more details of the law. In the last chapter, the 12th chapter, we had some really very serious discussion about idolatry, about how when they did go into the land, they were to destroy every vestige of idolatry. They were not to leave the groves, nor the altars, nor any of the images. They were not to use these things, and they were not to even inquire into these gods. They were not to ask about them or learn more about them. They were to completely destroy them as though they had never even been there, these idolatrous gods, and even to the fact that their name was not to even be remembered. Well, as we continue now along this line, he's still talking about this same subject of idolatry. And in this little chapter, 13th chapter, he tells three areas in which they're going to be tempted to go after other gods, and tells them how to deal with each area specifically. And the principles that are taught here definitely apply to us today, and there's some really good lessons here and some teaching that we don't get anyplace else except in this one place. So in chapter 13 of Deuteronomy, verse 1, if there arise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams and giveth thee a sign or a wonder, and the sign or wonder come to pass whereof he spake unto thee, saying, let us go after other gods which thou hast not known, let us serve them, thou shalt not hearken unto the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God proveth you to know whether ye love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Now this is a very interesting passage here. What he's saying is, if a prophet or a dreamer of dreams giveth thee a sign or a wonder. Now on the surface we'd say, well now, no prophet, no person who has visions is going to give any kind of a sign or a wonder that's going to promote idolatry. Just how could this come about? How could a sign or wonder be given that would entice anybody to go after another god? Now that's the premise that he gives here. If there arise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams and giveth thee a sign or a wonder, and the sign or wonder come to pass, whereof he spake unto thee, saying, let us go after other gods which thou hast not known, and let us serve them. So let's stop and think about this just for a moment. Is it possible for some kind of a sign or a wonder to come to pass that would be false, that would be misleading, that would indicate to us that we should serve other gods? Well, in this 13th chapter of Deuteronomy, he implies that it definitely is. And as we wonder about this, two things come to my mind. First of all is the case in Exodus 7, where Moses was in Egypt and approaching Pharaoh and trying to get Pharaoh to let the people go. And so he then threw his rod down and it turned into a serpent before Pharaoh and the servants. But in verse 11 of Exodus 7, then Pharaoh also called the wise men and the sorcerers, now the magicians of Egypt, they also did in like manner with their enchantments. For they cast down every man his rod, and they became serpents. But Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods. Now, it seems that these wise men and magicians over in Egypt also did a similar miracle to what Moses did. They cast their rods down, and they became serpents. Moses and Aaron's rod rather ate them up, but still there was a miracle involved there. And so it is possible then that from our reading here that a magician, a sorcerer, could produce something that if it's not an actual miracle would seem to be a miracle. Also, we have another fact added to this, this idea of God sending a strong delusion. In 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 9 and 10, Paul is talking about the apostate church, the false church, and how that it will use these signs and wonders to deceive people. He begins with the 9th verse, "Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders." This apostate church, which we know to be in name the Catholic Church, and all of those that would follow after it, this apostate church was going to have the ability to have power and signs and lying wonders after the working of Satan. Something here that's called power, and something here that's called signs, and then lying wonders. Now, a lying wonder would be a wonder that appeared to be a wonder, but it wasn't really a wonder at all, but it was really a lie. And as we know, there have been claims over the centuries, even down to this present day, of their ministers and of their followers being able to work miracles, able to heal people, able to do all kinds of things in a miraculous way. They even claim to have a miraculous inspiration from God. And he goes on to say in this second chapter of 2 Thessalonians, "And with all deceivableness of unrighteousness and them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believed not the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness." So we have to look at that point too. Not only could it be that false prophets could actually perform these miracles, but it's also very highly probable that when a person wants to believe something so badly that God sends them a strong delusion, that they should believe a lie. They believe that it is a wonder. They believe that it is a sign. They believe that it is a miracle. And they accept it as such, even though it's really and truly a lying wonder. And it causes them to believe a lie, which consequently then causes them to be damned because they did not have a love for the truth. Now, a person who has a love for the truth will not be deceived by any false prophet, by any kind of a sign or miracle or wonder. They will not be deceived by it, as we're going to learn in this chapter this evening. Now, he says, "This sign or wonder come to pass, whereof he spake unto thee, saying, Let us go after other gods, which thou hast not known, and let us serve them." Now, one of the most basic premises of all of the law of God is that there is but one God. There is one God. And you love this one God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. All of your entire being is to be put into the love for the one God. Now, any thought of there being other gods besides the one God is absolute heresy. It is something, an idea that's not to be entertained for the slightest moment. And so, consequently, when we have anything that's implying us to go after other gods that thou hast not known and to serve them, then this is something that we're not to entertain for one moment in our thoughts. Even though it may seem to come from somebody who has the ability to work miracles, we're not to entertain any idea like that. And so what we really have taught here then is that the doctrine as it's taught in the Word of God is not to be altered, even though a person claimed to have another revelation or a sign or a wonder or a miracle to teach something else. And it goes really hand in hand with what Paul said in Galatians 1, 8 and 9. He says, "But though we are an angel from heaven, preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached, let him be accursed. And as we said before, so say I now again, if any man preach any other gospel unto you than that you have received, let him be accursed." false is even though we ourselves come back, or an angel from heaven come, and preach any other gospel, let him be accursed. So we have here teaching that puts the Word of God way in above anything that might be coming from a prophet, or anything that might be coming from somebody who has some miraculous power of some kind. That we're not to heed if it conflicts with the Word of God. And so we have a whole group of people, for example, who claim to be the Latter-day Saints, who have another latter revelation that conflicts with the Word of God. And consequently, we're to treat it just as though they were to treat these false prophets back here in Deuteronomy, as well as what Paul says in Galatians. Now let's go on and see what he says here in verse 3. Thou shalt not hearken unto the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams. Now that's the attitude to take. You're not to hearken. And to hearken means to listen. You're not to listen to it. It doesn't mean that we're going to go down and hear something that conflicts with the Word of God, so we're going to go down and study it out more, and we're going to learn more about it, and we're going to get better educated in it. He doesn't say to do that. He says, thou shalt not hearken to it. Don't waste any more time listening to that. To that, the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams. For the Lord your God proveth you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. So really this is just a proof, a test, to see whether or not you really and truly love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. You're being tested. And if you want to be enticed by that or allow yourself to be duped by that, then you have failed the test. That's what he's saying here very simply. You shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice. And ye shall not serve him. And you shall serve him and cleave unto him. Now God is the one we're following. We listen to God. It's his voice that we hear as we read from his word. We do not hear any other word. We do not follow a man. Our doctrine doesn't depend upon a man, upon a man's revelation or a man's idea or anything like that. We follow after the voice of God. So, and you shall serve him and cleave unto him. And that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death. Now that's how that was to be handled. The person who started the teaching the false doctrine, even though he claimed to be a prophet, even though he claimed to have revelations, even though he had signs and wonders that came to pass, he was to be put to death. Because he has spoken to turn you away from the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt, and redeemed you out of the house of bondage, to thrust thee out of the way which the Lord thy God commanded thee to walk in. So shalt thou put the evil away from the midst of thee. Now this was not to be tolerated. It wasn't to be a situation where we say, well, we got a group over here that's following after so-and-so, and he claims that he's got a revelation, and he's doing something a lot different. They're using little idolatry. They have a few images. They have a few things that they have carved out, and they set up as in their midst. Or they're using the groves that were left here by the previous people. Or they now believe that there's really other gods, or there's really one God that all other people can pray to also. It doesn't really matter if it's just one living God, but just so you believe in God. They wouldn't allow anything like that. They would not tolerate that kind of a doctrine. That person was put to death. Now today, we, of course, do not use force in the Christian age and putting somebody to death. But we nevertheless do fight against all forms of false doctrine. In 2 Corinthians 10, beginning with verse 3, he says, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations, and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Now, our warfare today and our activity today is concerned with these imaginations, imagining something that is not true. We cast down imaginations. and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God. Our job, our duty, our station is to cast those things down. We do not tolerate them. We will not coexist with them. We will not allow them to put their doctrine in among us. And at the same time, we bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Anything that we can glean out, and we're doing that tonight, anything we can bring into captivity, that another thought that's going to help us to obey Christ, we want it, and we capture it. Now, beginning in the sixth verse, he shows another way that you might be tempted to go into idolatry. And this, if you think that idea of having a prophet or a dreamer of dreams to bring about some kind of a miracle or sign or wonder, if you think that was strong, just notice how strong this next temptation is. If thy brother, the son of thy mother, or thy son, or thy daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or thy friend. Now here, we're getting a lot closer to home now. This is anybody that's really close to us. That prophet could be a stranger. We may not even know him. But this is somebody that we've known, that we're closely associated with, a brother, or a sister, or a son, or a wife even, or a friend. The closest attachments that we can ever have in this life, that between husband and wife, or friends, or brothers and sisters, or parents and children. He says, which is as thine own soul. These people are so close to you, it's just like your own soul, it's your own flesh and your own blood. As thine own soul. Oh, this is getting so close now to home. This is not some stranger. This is not somebody that doesn't have any meaning to us. It's not somebody we can just say, I don't have anything more to do with you and just go our own way. This is somebody we're closely attached to. Thine own soul, he says. Entice thee secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which thou hast not known, thou nor thy fathers. Oh, this person is close. And this person got a lot of influence on us. This person can sway us. This person can speak, and we're going to listen. We're going to pay some attention to what this person had to say, because this person is close to us. And our whole life, our whole being is intertwined with this person. He's as thine own soul. But notice another thing he says here. Entice thee secretly. This idolatry is not something that likes to start off in the broad open. It likes to start off in a secret way. And there are many, many things even today that are so closely intermeshed with idolatry, and the whole organization is a secret organization. Just think of the secret orders today. And what goes on inside of their meetings is a deep secret. They're pledged to secrecy. But yet they are so closely related to idolatry. They're serving after other gods. They call their leaders and their associates most worshipful, master, and those kind of high-sounding titles that rival anything we'd ever even call God himself. They do it in secret. And so we learn one of the characteristics here of this thing. Entice thee secretly, saying, this person or persons that are so close to us is taking us into their confidence. They're talking about this thing in a secret, closed way. They know that if they come out in the open with it, they're going to be really cast down. They know that they're not going to be able to have any kind of a decent argument. But they get somebody in secret, and they get somebody in a quiet way where they have an influence over them, and then they entice them. And the bottom line of what they're saying is, let us go and serve other gods, which thou hast not known, thou nor thy father. Now, here are the types of gods that they would have you to go serve. This is the nature. Namely, of the gods of the people which are round about you, nigh unto thee, or far off from thee, from the one end of the earth even to the other end of the earth. Now, these gods that they're going to entice you to serve are going to be gods that are so popular that everywhere you look at, somebody's serving this kind of a god. You can find them close to you. You can find them far off. You can find them from one end of the earth to the other end. And one of the great arguments for this is that this is the thing that's so widely accepted. This is what the religious world is accepting now. For example, one of the phrases I've heard here lately is mainstream Christianity. The doctrines that fall within the line of mainstream Christianity. The doctrines that the major denominations kind of hold to. And these little splinter groups that are counted as the ones that are gone off on the deep end, they don't hold the doctrine that the mainstream group holds to. And so they make fun of you if you don't have one of these mainstream doctrines. One that you can just go anywhere and find people doing just that same way. Well, notice how this temptation is to be handled. Verse 8, thou shalt not consent unto him, nor hearken unto him. Neither shalt thine eye pity him, neither shalt thou spare, neither shalt thou conceal him, but thou shalt surely kill him. That's very strong language. Very strong language. But what it really means is, this is not to be tolerated. Not at all. Now, thou shalt not consent unto him, neither nor hearken unto him. You're not to listen to him. You're not to agree with him. You're not to go along with it. Now, I'll tell you, some of the greatest temptation we can have would be a temptation that we have brought on by somebody that close to us. But he says not to listen, not to hearken. Furthermore, not thine eyes shall not pity him, neither shalt thou spare, neither shalt thou conceal him. Don't even keep it hush. Don't conceal him. But thou shalt surely kill him. Now this phrase, thou shalt surely kill him, is interpreted by the Jewish scholars to mean that he is to be put to death according to the Jewish law. Now that means, of course, that you first of all go to the judge, and then the judge takes it to the he can't handle, he goes to a higher court, and on maybe even to the Sanhedrin. But when the sentence of death is passed, this person who first brought the charge, who was the eyewitness, this person would cast the first stone to stone him to death. So it says, thou shalt surely kill him. Thine hand shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. And thou shalt stone him with stones that he die, because he has sought to thrust thee away from the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Now that's pretty stern, severe punishment. Now think how hard it would be to do that. Your own son or daughter, your own brother or sister, your own wife, or a friend. That would be very hard to start those proceedings against that person that would end up in their being stoned to death, and you having to be the one that cast the first stone to bring about their death. You think God doesn't know that's hard? You think God doesn't realize that that's a tragic situation in your own life, that it's the hardest decision you've ever been called upon to make? Certainly God knows that. But nevertheless, that's how strong God feels about idolatry. These images, these altars, any of these things that are likenesses of the idolatrous religion, that's how strongly God feels about it. And we need to know first and always in our minds, we need to know that this great apostate church, which is called in the book of Revelation Babylon, Babylon the Great, it has harbored most of the idolatrous practices that have come down through the ages. Everything from using the cross as a sign or a symbol, everything from using their belfry towers, which degenerated into the steeples that are placed on top of church buildings today, everything from the bowing down and kissing of the Pope's ring, to the making of the sign of the cross, to bowing down to those statues and images that they have inside their buildings, all of these things are simply remnants of idolatry, and there's still idolatrous practices today. They claim also to have these signs and these wonders, and they claim also to be able to prophesy things that are not found in the Bible. And they hold doctrines that are not found in the Bible. But we need to be able to recognize those things for what they are and realize how strongly God felt and still feels about these idolatrous practices. He feels so strongly that he would have you to be instrumental in the putting to death of a member of your family under the Old Testament age if they were trying to entice you into that kind of a belief. And then verse 11, "And all Israel shall hear and fear, and shall do no more any such wickedness as this is among you." Now this punishment was not to be done just strictly for the sake of getting rid of the offender, but the punishment also was for the benefit of those of all the others who would hear and fear. They would hear what had happened, and they would fear as a result of it, and it would more impress upon them the sternness that God feels about going after another god or other gods. Now the third thing we have begins in verse 12. The first temptation was by a prophet or by a dreamer of dreams. The second temptation was by a member of your family or a close friend. Now the third temptation is if a city should turn after idolatrous gods. "If thou shalt hear say in one of thy cities, which the Lord thy God hath given thee to dwell there, saying, certain men, the children of Belial, are gone out from among you, and have withdrawn the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods which you have not known." Now there's the situation. Here's a city. Now this is a city which the Lord thy God hath given thee to dwell therein. It's not a heathen city. It's not a city that's inhabited by the Canaanites or the Gentiles. This is a city that the Lord has given his people to live in. It's inhabited by the Israelite people. But there have been certain men in that city who he describes here as being the children of Belial. Belial being another name for the devil. The children of Belial, they're gone out from among you and withdrawn the inhabitants of their city. Now, in other words, what they've done, they've taken this city and they have withdrawn it from the other religious community of the nation. They withdrawn the inhabitants, and the difference is saying, let us go and serve other gods which you've not known. Now when you hear about this, here's a city that has changed. You know, today we have such sad things as hearing about a congregation that's changed. A congregation that goes off into some doctrine that's just not in accordance with what the Bible teaches. A doctrine we believe would cause a person to lose their soul. And it would be about the same thing to us as hearing about that city for them. Well, the first thing he says, verse 14, "Then shalt thou inquire and make search and ask diligently, and behold, if it be the truth, and the thing certain that such an abomination is wrought among you." The first thing to do is to investigate it. Now, don't go off with some half information and start spreading a rumor that may not be true. He says to investigate this matter. And the way he describes it here is to inquire and make search and ask diligently, and behold if it be the truth, and the thing certain that such an abomination is wrought among you. It reminds us of the time back in Genesis 18 when Sodom and Gomorrah were so wicked, and the news was beginning to be spread about as to how wicked they were, as to what God did, Genesis 18, 20 and 21. "And the Lord said, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which is come unto me, and if not, I will know." Now, even God wouldn't take something just for hearsay like that. He said, I'll go down, I'm going to inquire, and I'm going to see whether or not it's that way. And if it's not that way, I'll know. I'll know if they're not that way or not. So that's what he demands here. Now, verse 15, thou shalt surely smite the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, destroying it utterly, and all that is therein, and the cattle thereof, with the edge of the sword. So this city was not to be allowed to stand. It was to be smitten with the edge of the sword. It was to be destroyed, destroying it utterly, and all that is therein, and the cattle thereof, the edge of the sword. And thou shalt gather all the spoil of it into the midst of the street thereof, and shall burn with fire the city, and all the spoil thereof, every whit, for the Lord thy God. And it shall be an heap forever. It shall not be built again. Now that's what was to happen to that city. God wanted it to be a heap forever and not be built again. Now this reminds us of some of the New Testament teaching that we have in 2 Peter 2, verses 20 and 22, where he talks about a person that's gone back into the world after he's known the gospel. For if after they have escaped the pollutions of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled therein and overcome, the latter end is worse with them than the beginning. For it had been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than after they have known it to turn from the holy commandment delivered to them. But it has happened unto them according to the true proverb, the dog is turned to his own vomit again, and the sow that was washed to her wallowing in the mire. It also reminds us of another scripture in 1 Corinthians 10, which I'd like to read, beginning with the 20th verse. About how we cannot allow ourselves to associate or to incorporate any idolatrous practices with our worship today. He says, but I say that the things with the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils and not to God, and I would not that you should have fellowship with devils. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of devils. You cannot be partakers of the Lord's table and of the tables of devils. Do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than He? Now we today, whenever we want to keep the communion with the Lord and at the same time keep communion with the devil, those two are not compatible and you cannot do that. And to do that is only to provoke the Lord to jealousy, just as this city was provoking God to jealousy, or just as one of these people who would entice another relative to commit this sin was provoking the Lord to jealousy, or just as a false prophet was doing so. We today can do the same thing. We can provoke the Lord to jealousy, and the only way we could stand while doing that would be to be stronger than the Lord. And he asked the question, are we stronger than the Lord? Do we provoke him to jealousy? And so we cannot afford to allow these idolatrous practices to come into our midst. And we're talking about the thing that comes straight from idolatry. All of the keeping of the religious holidays, which includes the Christ Mass Festival, the Easter, the Halloween. We just recently had Valentine's Day, on and on. These things come from idolatry. They do not come from the Bible. They are not from God. They are not to be incorporated in our practices. Even our language, we have to watch the things that we say. When we say, make a statement and we say, I'm going to knock on wood, what power are we appealing to? Certainly not God. God never told us to do that. What power are we appealing to? When we talk about luck, I have luck given to me. What power is that? It'd be much better to say, God was most beneficial to me. God extended his grace to me. God blessed me. Instead of to this nebulous thing known as luck that everybody appeals to when they're not even thinking about God. We have to watch these things. We are not to let these practices come in. We cannot partake of the table of the devils and the table of the Lord, not at the same time. It's an abomination. And we're simply provoking the Lord to jealousy when we do it. And so many of the things that we do come from traditions and not from the Bible, till we have to examine every action that we take to be sure that it comes from God and not from the world. Well, were to destroy any city that did this. And he says in verse 17, and there shall cleave naught of the cursed thing to thine hand. Now, these things they were to heap up and destroy. They were not to let any of it cleave to their hand. They were not to take any of the goods of this city out. There shall cleave naught of the cursed thing to thine hand, that the Lord may turn from the fierceness of his anger and show thee mercy and have compassion upon thee and multiply thee as he has sworn unto thy fathers. That was the only way to appease the Lord's anger here, was to completely destroy that city. Then when that happened, then the Lord may turn from the fierceness of his anger and show thee mercy and have compassion upon thee and multiply thee as he has sworn unto thy fathers. As long as that city stood in its idolatry and in its paganistic practice, God could not be appeased from his anger. Now, as we study the history of these Israelites, one thing that comes through to us is the fact that we have no record of them ever having done a city like this for idolatry. Never did they destroy a city that we have any record of because of their idolatry. They let it ride, they let it ride, they let it ride. And so, consequently, God was forced to destroy these cities. And as we've read in the book of Isaiah, the northern nation was taken away into captivity. And as we further read, the southern kingdom also was taken into captivity. And not only were the small cities guilty of this, destroyed, but the one major city, Jerusalem itself, was absolutely treated as one of these cities would have been treated here. Decimated, leveled, burned, and left as a place uninhabitable. So because the people wouldn't carry this out with a few, then God had to carry it out with the whole nation. And it's just like today, if we had have a body that has a cancer in it, and that cancer can be destroyed, and we leave it, we let it go, we let it grow, we let it spread, then eventually the whole body is going to be taken out by that one growth. So we see then the lessons of the past that very definitely apply to us today. So in verse 18 he concludes, when thou shalt hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God, to keep all his commandments which I have commanded thee this day, to do that which is right in the eyes of the Lord thy God. So God would keep his promises. He would multiply them. He would have compassion on them when they hearkened to his voice, when they did his commandments, and when they did that which is right in the eyes of the Lord thy God. Very simple things here, but yet they are all inclusive. They are all necessary if we're going to be acceptable to God. Well, we still have a few minutes, so let's go on into the first part of the 14th chapter, and we'll take the remainder of the time there. The 14th chapter has to do with some things that God wanted his people to practice that would make them different from the other peoples. Now, I'm sure there were other reasons for this besides just making them different, but these practices would make them outstandingly different from those round about. The first thing he mentions has to do with some dietary laws. And that goes through about the 21st verse of this chapter, and we won't get near that far. But let's read the first few verses here. Ye are the children of the Lord your God. Ye shall not cut yourselves, nor make any baldness between your eyes for the dead. For thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God. And the Lord hath chosen thee to be a peculiar people unto himself, above all nations that are upon the earth. Now the first thing we want to notice about these verses is the characteristics or the qualities that these people had. The first thing he says about them is the fact that ye are the children of the Lord your God, meaning that they have been adopted by God. They're not literally the fleshly children of God in that sense, but they've been adopted by God. This nation had been adopted, so that they would receive all of the rights and all of the privileges pertaining to the status of being a child of God. You're the children of God. Now, in that state of being adopted, then, God has some very special feeling because you've got all the right of anybody else in his family. The next thing he says about, along that line is the fact that they have had sanctification. Verse 2, he says, "For thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God." You've been set apart. You've been made clean. You are now holy. You're not somebody that is unclean or somebody that is unfit. You're a vessel that is appropriate for the Lord's use. You're a holy person. Then the third thing he says is, about their election, he says, "And the Lord had chosen thee to be a peculiar people unto himself above all nations that are upon the earth." They've been chosen by the Lord. That is, they've been elected. As we talk about this thing of being chosen or elected, we have described it many times this way. Here is, say, for example, a bus that is going to make a trip from one city to another. And everybody who gets on that bus then makes the trip. Now, those on the bus have been chosen to go. They've been set aside to make the trip. But whether or not they get on the bus is their choice. They don't have to choose to get on the bus. But once they get on, then they're elected to make the trip. And so it is with us. It is our choice whether or not we serve God. But once we decide to serve God and start doing that, then we become among that group that the Lord has elected to be saved. We can be in that group or not be in that group, but the group has been elected and the group's going to be saved. Whether or not we're part of it or not is our prerogative. And so here we have then a group of people that have been adopted as children of God. They have been sanctified so that they're now called holy people. They have been elected so that they've been known as chosen people. And so they're to behave in a different way from the other peoples of the earth. They're not to behave the same. What if they behave like everybody else? Somebody would say, "Well, so what? What difference does it make whether or not you're the child of God? Or whether or not you've been elected, or whether or not you have been made holy and sanctified. What difference does it make? You're no different from the other person who hasn't been." But they are to be different. That's what he's saying here. You're a peculiar people unto himself. You're above all nations that are upon the earth. And so for this reason, then, they're to do some things differently. And he names some of the things here. The first thing he names is, "Ye shall not cut yourself." You shall not cut yourselves. Now, as we stop and think about what it means here, to cut yourselves, this is some kind of a mutilation of the body. And as we understand it, the idolatrous peoples did, in times of mourning or grief, they would mutilate their body. They would cut themselves. Or they would mark themselves a certain way. These people had been circumcised. That was the only mark they were to have upon their body, so that they were children of God. And to put another mark on there would be an abomination. And as we stop and think about it, would not this include any kind of a mutilation of the body, any kind of a mark like a tattoo or like a scar that would deliberately put there as some kind of a sign? And we see this all the time. People who put a sign on their hand or on their arm or on their chest or on their foot or their leg, some kind of a sign there that indicates some message, some meaning. But doesn't that conflict with what he says, "You shall not cut yourselves nor make any baldness between your eyes for the dead"? Now, this making a baldness between the eyes was another form of mutilating yourself, cutting yourself as a sign of grief or mourning because somebody had died. God forbid his people to do that. He forbid them to carry out that practice that was a practice of those round about them. This was to be one of the things that set them apart from other peoples. They were not to do those things. And as we stop and think about it, first of all, I'd like to read 1 Kings 18. This in